Helen Keller had said in 1911, "We vote? What does that mean?" And Emma Goldman around the same time, "Our modern fetish is universal suffrage." After 1920, women were voting as men did, and their subordinate condition had hardly changed. Right after women got the vote, the measure of their social progress can be seen in an advice column written by Dorothy Dix that appeared in newspapers all over the country. The woman should not be merely a domestic drudge, she said. A man's wife is the show window where he exhibits the measure of his achievement. The biggest deals are put across over luncheon tables. We meet at dinner the people who can push our fortunes. The woman who cultivates a circle of worthwhile people, who belongs to clubs, who makes herself interesting and agreeable, is a help to her husband. Robert and Helen Lind, studying Muncie, Indiana in the late 20s, noted the importance of good looks and dress in the assessment of women. Also, they found that when men spoke frankly among themselves, they were likely to speak of women as creatures purer and morally better than men, but as relatively impractical, emotional, unstable, given to prejudice, easily hurt, and largely incapable of facing facts or doing hard thinking. A writer in early 1930, Boosting the Beauty Business, started off a magazine article with the sentence, "The average American woman has 16 square feet of skin." He went on to say that there were 40,000 beauty shops in the country and that $2 billion was spent each year on cosmetics for women, but this was insufficient. American women are not yet spending even one-fifth of the amount necessary to improve their appearance. He then gave an itemized list of the annual beauty needs of every woman: 12 hot oil treatments, 52 facials, 26 eyebrow plucks, etc. It seems that women have been best able to make their first escape from the prison of wifeliness, motherhood, femininity, housework, beautification, isolation, when their services have been desperately needed, whether in industry or in war or in social movements. Each time practicality pulled the woman out of her prison, in a kind of work parole program, the attempt was made to push her back once the need was over, and this led to women's struggle for change. World War II had brought more women than ever before out of the home into work. By 1960, 36% of all women 16 and older, 23 million women, worked for paid wages. But although 43% of women with school-aged children worked, there were nursery schools for only 2%. The rest had to work things out themselves. Women were 50% of the voters, but even by 1967, they held 4% of the state legislative seats and 2% of the judgeships. The median income of the working woman was about one-third that of the man, and attitudes towards women did not seem to have changed much since the 20s. "There is no overt anti-feminism in our society in 1964, wrote feminist and sociologist Alice Rossi, "not because sex equality has been achieved, but because there is practically no feminist spark left among American women." In the civil rights movement of the 60s, the signs of a collective stirring began to appear. Women took the place they customarily took in social movements, in the front lines, as privates, not generals. In the office of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in Atlanta, a Spelman College student named Ruby Doris Smith, who had been jailed during the sit-ins, expressed her anger at the way women were relegated to the routine office work, and she was joined in her protest by two white women in SNCC, Sandra Hayden and Mary King. The men in SNCC listened to them respectfully, read the position paper they had put together asserting their rights, but did not do very much. Ella Baker, a veteran fighter from Harlem, now organizing in the South, knew the pattern. "I knew from the beginning that as a woman, an older woman, in a group of ministers who are accustomed to having women largely as supporters, there was no place for me to have come into a leadership role." Nevertheless, women played a crucial role in those early dangerous years of organizing in the South and were looked on with admiration. Many of these were older women like Ella Baker and Amelia Boynton in Selma, Alabama, and Mama Dolly in Albany, Georgia. Younger women, Gloria Richardson in Maryland, Annelle Ponder in Mississippi, were not only active, but leaders. Women of all ages demonstrated, went to jail. Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer, a sharecropper in Ruleville, Mississippi, became legendary as organizer and speaker. She sang hymns. She walked picket lines with her familiar limp. As a child, she contracted polio. She roused people to excitement at mass meetings. I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. Around the same time, white middle-class professional women were beginning to speak up. A pioneering early book, strong and influential, was Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique. In it, she wrote, "Just what was the problem that has no name? What were the words women used when they tried to express it? Sometimes a woman would say, 'I feel empty somehow, incomplete,' or she would say, 'I feel as if I don't exist.' Sometimes, a tired feeling. I get so angry with the children, it scares me. I feel like crying without any reason." Friedan wrote out of her experience as a middle-class housewife, but what she spoke about touched something inside all women. The problem lay buried, unspoken for many years, in the minds of American women. It was a strange stirring, a sense of dissatisfaction, a yearning that women suffered in the middle of the 20th century in the United States. Each suburban wife struggled with it alone, as she made the beds, shopped for groceries, matched slipcover material, ate peanut butter sandwiches with her children, chauffeured Cub Scouts and brownies, lay beside her husband at night. She was afraid to ask even of herself the silent question, "Is this all?" But on an April morning in 1959, I heard a mother of four having coffee with four other mothers in a suburban development 15 miles from New York say in a tone of quiet desperation, "The problem." And the others knew, without words, that she was not talking about a problem with her husband or her children or her home. Suddenly they realized they all shared the same problem, the problem that has no name. They began hesitantly to talk about it. Later, after they had picked up their children at nursery school and taken them home to nap, two of the women cried in sheer relief just to know they were not alone. The mystique that Friedan spoke of was the image of the woman as mother, as wife, living through her husband, through her children, giving up her own dreams for that. She concluded, "The only way for a woman, as for a man, to find herself, to know herself as a person, is by creative work of her own." In the summer of 1964, in Macomb, Mississippi, at a Freedom House, a civil rights headquarters where people worked and lived together, the women went on strike against the men who wanted them to cook and make beds while the men went around in cars organizing. The stirring that Friedan spoke of was true of women everywhere, it seemed. By 1969, women were 40% of the entire labor force of the United States, but a substantial number of these were secretaries, cleaning women, elementary school teachers, saleswomen, waitresses, and nurses. One out of every three working women had a husband earning less than $5,000 a year. What of the women who didn't have jobs? They worked very hard at home, but this wasn't looked on as work, because in a capitalist society, or perhaps in any modern society where things and people are bought and sold for money, if work is not paid for, not given a money value, it is considered valueless. Women began to think more about this fact in the 1960s, and Margaret Benston wrote about it, The Political Economy of Women's Liberation. Women doing housework were people outside the modern economic system. Therefore, they were like serfs or peasants, she said. The women who worked in the typical woman's job, secretary, receptionist, typist, salesperson, cleaning woman, nurse, were treated to the full range of humiliations that men in subordinate positions faced at work, plus another set of humiliations stemming from being a woman. Jibes at their mental processes, sexual jokes and aggression, invisibility except as sexual objects, cold demands for more efficiency. A commercial, Guide to Clerical Time Standards, printed a question and answer column. Question: I'm a businessman and my secretary seems to move entirely too slowly. How many times a minute should she be able to open and close a file drawer? Answer: exactly 25 times. Times for other open and close operations are 0.04 minutes for opening or closing a folder and 0.026 minutes for opening a standard centered desk drawer. If you're worried about her chair activity, clock her against these standards got up from chair, 0.033 minutes, turn in swivel chair, 0.009 minutes. A woman factory worker in New Bedford, Massachusetts in the early 70s, in a medium-sized corporation whose president's dividends from the corporation in 1970 amounted to $325,000, wrote in an organizing newspaper that 9% of the workers in her department were women, but all the supervisors were men. A few years ago, I was suspended for 3 days from work because my children were still young and I had to take time off when they were sick. They want people who keep quiet, squeal on one another, and are very good little robots. The fact that many have to take nerve pills before starting their day, and a week doesn't go by that there aren't two or three people who break down and cry, doesn't mean a thing to them. She added, "But times are changing, and from now on, more people will speak out and demand from their so-called bosses that they be treated the way the bosses themselves would like to be treated."